On the Empire Podcast this week, we talk to the man behind the papier-mâché mask. Yes, it's Frank himself, Michael Fassbender, and we chat with two directors who must have feet like traction engines. It's Mike Brett and Steve Jameson from Excellent Football Doc, Next Goal Wins, plus the usual movie news and nonsense on the only movie podcast that loudly said the word panic just as Mike Lee walked past just the other day. True story. Hard to tell from his expression whether he heard or cared, quite frankly. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. As ever, the rules of the pod are simple. One pod booth, four people go in, four people come out again. First up is a man whose insane theories on sequels are notorious. He thinks Naked Gun 2.5 is better than Naked Gun. He prefers Ghostbusters 2 to Ghostbusters. And he probably thinks Godfather 1 and 2 are passable prequels to Godfather 3. It's Nick Dissemblian. Hello.
Chris, don't make me poison, stab, shoot, hang, stretch, disembowel, draw and quarter you. The fate that befell Viggo the Carpathian.
I thought you'd been reading about Rasputin. Wow.
No.
Next up, we have a geek queen, a lady whose theories and sequels aren't quite as crackpot. Although as a fan of dragons, her favourite follow-up is Reign of Fire 2, in which a dragon becomes a prime minister and hilarity ensues. Rated 12A for violence and dragon nudity. It's Helen O'Hara!
that was a particular favourite of mine.
It was a good one. Next up, last but not least, is the exuberant young whippersnapper who edits this podcast. His favourite sequel is a new upgrade to whatever editing programme he uses to edit this podcast. You know the one. I don't have to say that by name, but I do have to say his name by name. Ali Plum by name. Hello, Ali Plum.
Hello.
You've been sending in your questions all week, not rudely and unbidden, but because we asked you to. Here are the very, very best. This week, all from the twits. At ChrisArcher523 asks, in light of recent news, the recent news in this case being Star Wars Episode 7, what are the best and worst examples of getting the old band back together in film?
This is a hard one for me because my favourite is gathering the team back together film is the one where we haven't seen them together before, the Blues Brothers. So we come in and basically the Blues Brothers reunite their band and have to go around and collect them all from wherever, whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. But of course we haven't seen, you know, the Saturday night shows or the stage shows or anything else. So it's kind of, it's a slightly sneaky answer to the question.
That's a good answer, though.
It's also the answer to the question because they literally say, we're putting
the band back together. Yeah, this is also true.
I wrote a blog on something similar to this a few years ago for the Empire website, which was about the need that some sequels feel to crowbar everyone from the first movie back into the second movie. For example, I don't know why this is springing up my head right now, but National Treasure Book of Secrets brings back Harvey Keitel's character for no good reason whatsoever, apart from the fact that he just happened to be in the first movie. And I don't like, you know, Joe Pesci in Lethal Weapon 3. There's no need for Joe Pesci in Lethal Weapon 3 or 4. He was great in Lethal Weapon 2. You know, it's just when you feel like a character works in one instance, it doesn't have to work in the next one.
I like his speech about the frog, though, which I think is in 4.
I don't remember 4 that much, to be honest.
It was a really sweet speech about the frog, and actually, so I'm allowing him that one.
They do that a lot in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Yes.
They bring back everyone, apart from the Kraken, who they should bring back. I'd love it if the Kraken just turned up in the further sequels. Yeah, so are we talking about literal bands or...
No, we're talking about the idea of old casts coming back together.
Well, surely for you it's Ghostbusters 2.
Yes, but I mean there wasn't that much time that passed, I think, to have a getting back together big
but
event thing.
I mean the trope where you have, at the beginning of the film, they gather
they've
everyone.
Disbanded, yeah.
Where have you been?
Parties.
Where have you been? You know, the Mighty Ducks.
Absolutely.
They're shit every time. They just won the previous film. At the very end, they somehow managed to do it through ingenuity and skill, and then they have to get them together again, and what, you're all crap again? Oh, come on.
Did we learn nothing?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Fast Five, obviously has to get a mention, just because everybody turns up for no reason. Everybody they've had a conversation with the previous four films.
Like, those two guys who deal with the toilet in Fast Five, they don't come back for Fast Six.
I
think that was a big part of the fact that movie wasn't as good.
I guess the big news that at ChrisArcher523 is referring to is Mrs. Doubtfire 2, and we're going to find out where Stew has been.
Yeah,
where Mrs. Doubtfire's left breast has been, where her right breast has been. It's going to be fascinating to see what's happened to all those iconic characters.
That's an incredibly good point.
It is going to be good.
More recently, we've had Anchorman 2, which I didn't think was very well done. Part of me enjoyed the Bat fast food restaurant.
Chicken of the Cave.
Then the Muppets did it, obviously, in a very huge part of the film. Was it a huge part of it? Oceans 12 and 13 did it. I know you've got a soft spot for Oceans 12, Chris. Red does the same thing that Blues Brothers does in terms of going, hey, here are all these guys. But there's kind of an implied Oh, okay. So I kind of can work it out from the cliches.
There's a lot to be said for an implied backstory.
I like recruitment movies. Sounds wrong. Yep. In which people are recruited, not just like a band getting the band back together again, but movies like Magnificent Seven, and yes, Armageddon to an extent. Movies like Uncommon Valor, which is a wonderful / dreadful Gene Hackman action movie from the 1980s, directed by Ted Kotcheff, just after First Blood. And it's awful. Hackman basically assembles a team to go into Vietnam to get his son back. He's like a grizzled old colonel. And the team's like Patrick Swayze and Randall Tex Cobb and Fred Ward. And it's great fun, but it's absolute bollocks. I love that. And Avengers did it brilliantly recently.
Yeah, Avengers did
absolutely
it
brilliantly.
Well.
In Star Trek the Motion Picture, everyone's favourite Star Trek movie, there's a sort of getting the, maybe not the band, but the trio back together. And there's a scene very early on which is stuck in my mind where McCoy is being banded back together and he's wearing the most extraordinary skin tight white trousers. If you've ever seen the film, it will stick in your mind. They're just like, you are too old for those. I know it's the future, but that's not acceptable.
Can you see the whole DeForest?
Both what? DeForest and Kelly, yes.
What about Bones?
All of Bones.
Oh my word. That's extraordinary.
The costumes in that movie may be the worst costumes in any major film ever. I'm not kidding. They've got these kind of flesh-coloured trousers that go over their shoes. It's just,
yeah, it's just
it's
bad.
It's just awful.
You can see Spock's salute at all times.
All right. Are we done?
I think so.
I think definitely.
All right. As ever, you know, we did this last week. What was the question we did last week about people who played characters played by multiple people in different films and or different franchises? And we said that, you know, as ever, these lists aren't exhaustive. We're doing them off the top of our heads. And we got lots of responses in last week. You know, people were saying things like Joe Don Baker, who plays, you know, plays a bad guy in Living Daylights and then pops up as Wade in the first two Pierce Brosnan Bond movies.
Yeah, well, which Bond
Maude
girl?
Adams
appears,
in
yeah.
Octopussy and The Man with the Golden Gun as well. So it's something that Bond does an awful lot. And there were a whole bunch of other ones as well people sent in.
I think the other one was Paul, and I never know how to pronounce his name, even though I've asked him directly, Dano or Dano, who obviously is in twice.
And There Will Be Blood.
And There Will Be Blood. And so the story goes, because the person they wanted dropped out, or they decided not to use him, and they just went, you know who'd be good?
The guy we've already got.
Yeah, so they just made it a brother, and it was jobs are good.
We've got, you know, loads. Tom Crooms sent in Cheech Marin in Dusk Till Dawn. He plays multiple roles in that. Ian Robertson sent in Pat Roach, the great Pat Roach, who pops up in every Indiana Jones movie apart from... he popped in all three. All three. Yeah, let's keep that one going. And someone said, did you know that Harrison Ford and River Phoenix played the same character in an Indiana Jones film?
I did
not know that.
That's incredible news.
It's incredible.
Just to reverse the question, and at the risk of, you know, doing this one to death, but going back to the original one here by Chris Archer, 523, there's something to be said about movies. We don't like it when they have to get everyone back, but it is weird when you get half of them back, there's a noticeable absence. So if you look at the cinematic masterclass that is Beverly Hills Cop 3.
I was just about to say that.
You
oh
have
my God.
The terrible scene where your favourite judge is explaining his job.
You're right.
And it's like, oh, I'm the department of ABA123 said. Where's the other guy? He's retired, fishing. He's not here. Just shut up. Here's a new guy who plays exactly that role in that position.
Poor,
a bit old.
Poor John Ashton.
A bit curmudgeonly. And shall we carry on?
I asked Judge Reinhold about that. I interviewed him last year about the Beverly Hills Cop TV pilot, which got made and never shown anywhere. And I asked about John Ashton. It sounded like there was some bad blood between him and Eddie Murphy. They might have had a fight in a pub car park with their shirts off. I don't know. Just guessing.
At this point, you're embroidering, right? Just to be clear, for our lawyers.
Yes. At no point did John Ashton take his shirt off in a pub car park. To our knowledge.
We don't know that. We don't know you could have done. Okay.
The truth is out there. But yeah, just to make the point that sometimes when you have that extended sequel and you don't have that guy, it can be odd.
Mm. The banana in the tailpipe wasn't in that one.
It wasn't in that one.
Wanted too much money.
They did have the person dying so that he can go and do a thing. They brought that back.
Yep.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Did Serge come back in Beverly Hills Cop 3?
No, I don't believe he did.
But George Lucas was there, so great.
George was there.
George Lucas was there indeed. All right. Once again, we haven't exhausted that. If you can think of anyone else that we've missed, then please do send in. Next one's from Damien Barrett, at Damien Barrett, sorry. What character from a TV series would you most like to see get his own movie spin-off? And he suggests Parks and Rec's Little Sebastian.
Who is a tiny horse.
Yeah, a dead tiny horse really? As well. Yeah.
Wow. Well,
you haven't reached that bit, have you?
Spoilers.
No, yeah. I'm still...
season three, my friend.
Okay. All right, I'm still on season two, but okay. All right, what would that spin-off consist of?
I don't know.
It'd be a tiny, adorable horse.
It's a ghostly horse having ghostly adventures.
Sounds like one of kind of film that Phil would watch. Just sort of a stuffed inanimate horse.
The Turin horse,
in black and white.
Yes.
Yeah.
The ghostly adventures of the stuffed horse, Little Sebastian.
There's a great song, the Little Sebastian song. Go and listen to it right now.
All right, I'm going to look up, do a deep dive into
Nick,
the
you're not a big fan of Parks and Rec, are you? Because you have no soul.
Well, I began watching season one on Netflix. I watched about six episodes. I didn't find it very funny, but then... Okay, well, I watched all of it then. this was a while back, and then I've been told I'm an idiot several times since.
No, the first season is bad. I love the show. The first season's not very good.
I keep hearing it gets better. I'm going to go back to it once I've done Futurama.
It's the Red Dwarf thing. The first season is just shocking.
I'm going to watch it at some point.
I would say for who I'd like to get their own spin-off, movie-wise, Game of Thrones, I want The Hound and Arya to have their own spin-off where they just go and do stuff, have adventures, get into scrapes, fall into wells, steal everyone's food, kill people. That's what I'd like to see. I'd also like to see Brienne of Tarth and Pod get their own spin-off in a similar adventuring, wandering around the place, again, falling down wells and murdering people.
I've been thinking about this a little bit because, and I'm going to say it, Supernatural has just had, just had what's called, and this was a new phrase on me a few months ago, a backdoor pilot.
Helen, my understanding of Supernatural was that it's constantly had a backdoor pilot.
You're very funny. But it's basically, this is where they sneakily introduce a situation to a regular episode of the show, which they actually hope to spin off in a completely new direction.
So not to be confused with a backdoor lover.
Indeed not. By Dujour, which is a great song, everybody.
American TV shows love this. The American Office did this with the Dwight Schrute Farm show. They wanted to have essentially... Because Dwight Schrute is a fantastic character within that. They really took the original thing and did something with it. And I don't blame them for doing it, but the backdoor pilot doesn't work.
Well, this didn't, for my money anyway, because what they essentially did was leave all the regular characters off to one side and introduced this ridiculous, complicated Vampire Diaries-esque society of different kinds of monsters living in Chicago. Like, so five families ruling Chicago, but each family is a different kind of monster, right? So you've got, but they're all like rich people living in rich houses and looking like they're straight out of a catalogue shoot, and it was not something I'm rushing to watch.
Sounds great.
Let's put it
sounds like Divergent.
But if you did like launch some of the characters from Supernatural on their own show, I genuinely think Cass would, who's an angel, who's slightly, you know, he's almost kind of, he looks at the world in a very unusual way. That would be an interesting show to me. Speaking of people who look at the world in an interesting way, Troy and Abed in the morning. Let's make that happen.
Oh, poor Troy.
He'll be back.
That ain't happening anymore.
He's just
gone.
Sailing. He'll be back, Chris.
By the way, spoilers for Community, in case you're wondering. But Donald Glover, the actor, plays Troy, famously, I think, left the show. He's only in five episodes of season five. So he's not dead.
He's not dead.
Gone. He's gone.
He could be back.
He's left the show. The backdoor pilot, CSI does it an awful lot. Or used to, anyway. But they're about to do it again. Patricia Arquette's about to head up a new show, I think called Cyber Crimes. I'm not entirely sure of the title of that. I could look it up, but what fun would that be? But yeah, she's going to appear in a new episode of CSI coming up soon. And then get her own spin-off. But that's a spin-off, TV spin-off. We're talking about movie spin-offs. I'd like to see the baby in the drawer from the British Empire.
I thought you were going to say 24.
Good shout.
Because this is, if anyone remembers the British Empire, with completely demented sitcom, more demented than people give it credit for. If you go back and reread the synopsis, it's like, what the hell is going on this show that went out at 7 p.m. on the BBC One on a weeknight? Carol, Mr. British's secretary, who used to go, yes, Mr. British, had a baby. Didn't let anyone know she had a baby, so kept it in a drawer under her desk at the reception of the leisure centre. Now that's a serial killer waiting to happen, and I want to see that. I want to see that stalking and picking off the old members of the British Empire cast until Gordon comes back and has to fight.
So that's where the makers of 24 got. There's a famously a bit with a baby in a drawer in
CTU. Really?
Yeah. It's not the higher point of the show, I'll be honest. It's just above the cougar.
We just did a feature on the website sort of summarising everything that happened over the last eight seasons of 24 for those who might have forgotten or who might not have seen all the seasons.
It's very hard to keep track.
Live Another Day, which is showing obviously now. I was reading through it. I'll be honest, I gave up after season one. Maybe saw a couple of episodes of season two. It's mental. It's utterly, utterly mental. That entire show from beginning to end
Nick gets
is
very
crazed.
Angry if you cast aspersions on 24.
He Helen, it is utterly realistic.
Yeah. He accused me the other day on Twitter of calling 24 trash TV, words which never left my mouth. But now I call it trash TV every day and just see what happens.
Well,
but, you know, it's fun. It's bonkers. It's no more bonkers than British Empire.
It's got some very, very great moments in it.
What would you like to see?
Right, I want to see, apart from Babies and Drawers, that sounds great. You know, we're getting Better Call Saul, but I'd love to see a Gus spin-off movie with Giancarlo Esposito about his shadowy past in Chile. They don't really go into his background, but Don Eladio spares his life based on his past in Chile. He says, I know who you are, you're not in Chile anymore. So I'd love to see what the hell he did to get his reputation. I'd love to see Michael the Geordie from Alan Partridge. I think a lot of it would be, a high percentage of it would be him shitting in boxes, flinging the odd monkey into the nearest body of water.
But Michael the Geordie, box shitter.
Simon Greenall, who plays that character, that accent is astonishing. He's so good.
But it's so interesting. At the awards, the Empire Awards, which we had not too long ago, we had the whole Alan Partridge crew down there. And I walked past Simon Greenall and Felicity Montague having a chat, and they are nothing like their characters. They're, you know, very kind of...
I kind of tend to watch reality TV programmes these days, and I think...
Greg the Egg, the movie.
Yeah, I would love to see Greg Wallace get his own movie. That'd be amazing. Just him and John Turode eating food and going,
No Turode. It's just Greg on the road.
No, I love Turode. No. Turode on the road? On the Turode.
Is this MasterChef for people who don't watch trash TV?
The Turode.
What the fuck did you just say?
Revenge.
What did you just say?
Sweet revenge.
MasterChef is quality entertainment, well made, with good production values.
It is well seasoned and full of flavour.
Fricasseed onions are fantastic.
Would you want to see a kind of crime based spin off? You know, them solving crimes using kitchen implements?
That would be amazing. I've got it. All the TV detectives team up. All of them. They all team up. Like Columbo, teams up with Morse.
Sherlock.
It teams up with Sherlock, and because there's a murder that's happened, and it's like nobody can solve it.
I think it needs to be Murder by Death, but with the current TV show.
Yes.
But Grissom, Mark Ruffalo plays Columbo.
Mark Ruffalo.
I'm just saying.
Because Peter Falk.
Because Peter Falk sadly is no longer with us.
Absolutely. So Mark Ruffalo, that's a good show.
So would you have Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch turning up on the set and then going, I'm Sherlock.
Yeah,
I'm Sherlock.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd
and then they could wrestle.
And then Grissom.
We know that there's a third brother in Sherlock.
Yes.
And we also know that Johnny Miller's character has a brother, and I don't believe he's been introduced, so
twins,
it works.
Both called Sherlock.
This is all coming together.
We don't have time for it anyway.
Let's absolutely do that. Grissom comes in and like potters around with the crime scene. Then Will Graham and Hotch from the BAU come in and like they do some investigative
Somebody
stuff as well.
Somebody has to take off his sunglasses.
Right. Now we've answered that question to the best of our abilities.
James, sorry to interrupt. James Dyer wanted me to chip in with a prepared statement. He wants to see he wants to see Toby from the West Wing stroking his beard and being misanthropic.
Amen.
I think Daryl from The Walking Dead needs his own movie as well.
Yes, he does.
That's all I have to say.
He can stroke Toby's beard.
He does need his own movie. I actually saw at Comic-Con a lot of people wearing T-shirts which said, if they kill Daryl, we riot.
Yeah.
So I feel like the fan base is ready.
Yeah. Honestly, because he's one of the few characters who doesn't exist in the comic books, and he's become such a fan favourite. And like everyone in The Walking Dead is vulnerable at some point. You just think,
I don't think
if
he
they
is.
Kill him.
In my head, he's always invulnerable. When he has a scene, that's part of the reason why I like it.
Yeah.
Because it gives you a break. You go, well, he's going to survive because he's the boss.
Yeah.
And he has an unlimited number of arrows.
He certainly does. I don't know. That question's been... That's the most answered the question's ever been. This new one from @_culturemouse, who asks, with the release this week of The Wind Rises, the last film from Miyazaki, what are your favourite Miyazaki moments and characters? Now, I should announce at this point that the minute Dan Jolin hears the words Miyazaki, he appears as if by magic. Just appears, which is really weird if you're in the bath or having a poo. Anyway.
Why are you saying Miyazaki either in the bath or having a poo?
Why wouldn't you?
Good point.
Carry on.
And magically, Dan Jolin has appeared. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Chris.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank
That's
you.
That's great,
I'm fine.
Dan.
It was really odd. I kind of had this strange twitching feeling in my head and I just felt compelled to come up here.
Did you get the cat bus up?
Don't spoil my answer.
All right, Dan, you popped in for 45 seconds. What's your favourite Miyazaki moment and your favourite Miyazaki character? Because you're a Miyazaki expert, aren't you?
Well, I'm a huge fan. I've met him. I've been to Studio Ghibli.
Okay.
And everything. So, yeah. It's kind of cool.
Is he a nice man?
He's a very, very nice man. As a matter of fact, because we had to interview through translator, he didn't mind the fact that the interview went on three times as long as it should have. Which is cool.
Okay.
But the ultimate Miyazaki moment. I would also say, I'd say this is my favourite ever moment in animation. I think this is a masterclass of animation. And that's the moment in My Neighbour Totoro where the two girls are waiting for the bus in the rain, sharing an umbrella. And then Totoro turns up next to them and they give him an umbrella and... He's overjoyed. He loves it. But the way, just it's mostly silent, so it's complete visual storytelling. And the way the water and the rain is animated is absolutely beautiful. And it's such a tender, overjoyous, that's not a word, but I've just said it, overjoyous moment. And then there's a little toad crawling across the road. These little details, I love them. And then of course, the cat bus arrives, and it's this kind of explosion of amazing surreality.
Just like you arriving in the middle of this podcast with no... No introduction.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and your favourite Miyazaki character?
My favourite Miyazaki character. I'm very fond of No Face in Spirited Away.
Okay.
Complex character.
I thought you'd give a hat tip to our favourite Flying Pig movie.
Oh, Porco.
The old Porco.
Porco. Bit of Porco. That's an interesting one, Porco Rosso, because it's his most adult film until The Wind Rises anyway.
But it's about flying pigs.
It is about a flying pig.
Which word can we say to get rid of Dan? Sorry. No.
Michael Bay? I don't know.
How about these words? Thank you, Dan. Now go away. That was great. Jolin, everybody.
Hey.
That was fantastic. Well done, Dan. Well done.
Can we answer this too?
Yes, of course we can. Absolutely. But I felt Dan Young,
sure,
having been to Studio Ghibli, as we have, Nick.
We have.
We have been there. We've been to the Ghibli Museum. Nick is a massive Miyazaki fan. I, to my eternal shame, have only seen one film.
And that was
Princess Mononoke.
Oh, Chris.
I wasn't that fussed. And,
Chris.
But I went to the Ghibli Museum with Nick anyway.
Yep.
Nick was in raptures. He was in heaven. I just looked at all the cute things and thought it was very nice.
It's surprisingly difficult to get in. You have to.
It was, yeah.
You have to kind of order your tickets way in advance, and you have to go to a shop and this shop in Tokyo where they have a kind of vending machine type thing that's completely in Japanese. There's no English at all, so we found it quite difficult to get our tickets out, even having bought them. But when you get there, it's amazing. It's like this huge castle, and they have a huge screening room where you can watch a short film.
In Japanese, because one of the great things about going to Japan is that they don't make any concessions whatsoever for English-speaking people. And so you're just going around this museum that has no signs in English, and the short film they show you has no English subtitles. But it was still amazing.
It's an amazing place, and you go up, and on the roof they have an actual huge cat bus that you can get in. And you can also get Ghibli beer. It's amazing. They have little Totoros on the label. But
Phenomenal.
You can just have a nice beer.
Phenomenal. But you a fan, Helen?
I'm very much a fan, yes. I love the weirdness of the films. I love that he's not afraid to kind of stop everything and just, let characters sit for a while. I mean, one of my favourite moments is probably Chihiro and No Face just sitting on the train in Spirited Away, and they're just sitting there looking ahead as the train spins along through a flooded landscape. And it's the kind of moment that very, very few animation studios, even the great American ones, they don't really always have the
blue sky.
Sure. So, things like, and also just the sheer weirdness of it. There's always bits in Miyazaki movies which you don't quite understand, but you're kind of just okay, large sections which you don't quite understand, but you just get caught up in it and you just go along with it. And I mean, I remember our review of Howl's Moving Castle, which is an adaptation of one of my favorite authors, Diana Wynne Jones. There's a sort of an action scene where it's basically two old ladies trying to climb some stairs. That's nearly the closest you've got to a sort of an action face-off in that movie. And that's weird, but kind of awesome.
That was the original premise for Step Up to the Streets.
I want to give a shout-out to my friend Ali McClay, who I shared a flat with some years back, and he is an absolute obsessive. He loves me. He loves Ghibli films, and that's how I got into it through him. But they are awesome. And my tip is to double bill Spirited Away with Labyrinth, because there's a lot of similarities. Yep. If you watch them back to back, it's quite an experience. You probably need therapy afterwards.
Can you see anybody's Vulcan salute?
Leggings are not quite as tight and Spirited Away, let's put it that way.
You a fan, Ali? You got a favourite character, favourite moment?
I feel like we've answered this question enough, and I don't think I've got that much to say because I'm more of a Totoro person than anything else, and Dan's kind of nailed that one.
You can say the same thing, that's fine.
Well, there's this bit where, I don't want to tell you everything, but there are two characters waiting for a bus in the rain, and then another character comes along, and then he gets given a number, and there's this little tiny frog. I think it's a toad.
Yeah.
And I love these little details.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Love that scene. So where shall I start?
Spirited Away, obviously. Spirited I think Away. That's most people's entry point since it came out, obviously. I mean, Totoro is a brilliant first film for little kids. I have recommended this to a lot of friends, children, and they go nuts for it. Because it doesn't have much in the way of plot or even dialogue in some parts, but it's just so much imagination and colour and crazy beautiful things. I like Laputa Castle in the Sky, but I don't think it's as essential. I haven't seen Kiki's Delivery Service,
that's
I must
the one
confess.
I was going to say could be a really good entry point.
Okay.
Because it's actually really fun and light. Spirited Away is fantastic, but it's quite an intense, heavier one.
Yeah, I think it's more of an entry point for adults, that one, than
I'm hearing what
kids.
You're saying. I'm going to go with My Neighbor Totoro.
Totoro does have an incredibly catchy theme tune.
It's got an absolutely amazing.
But you may want to make the decision whether you want to watch it in Japanese with subtitles or with the English dub, because the
English dub
is a bit fierce.
Never English
they go Totoro.
Actually, the English, I will correct you on that. Some of the English dubs for Miyazaki films are great.
I know they've got big names, but...
Well, not just that, but John Lasseter oversaw them because he's a huge... In fact, virtually all of Pixar are huge Miyazaki fans, but him in particular is a massive Miyazaki fan. He was very, very much behind the push to get his more recent films into cinemas in the US, and that's why he got these big names. But he also oversaw it and made sure that he got good big names who could do a really good job on the dub. So the dubs for, I mean, Howl's Moving Castle.
Christian Bale does a great
Christian
job.
Christian Bale is great as Howl. It's one of his best roles, honestly. But Spirited Away and Mononoke as well, they're all really, really good.
Phenomenal. I stand corrected. Nick, you collect Totoros, don't you?
I actually have not got a single Totoro because I gave them all away.
No way.
Yep, that was stupid.
You had them euthanized.
I bought tons. I bought so many when
did
I was
you give
in.
Them away?
When I gave them all to friends.
You kept a t-shirt about you, though.
I wear that regularly.
Good. The friendship is on. Teetering on the brink there. I have
a Miyazaki Club t-shirt I got at Comic-Con.
Oh, you do? That's awesome. Yeah, that's really good. I like that one. Oh, well done. Okay, fantastic. Loved those questions. And thank you to Dan for his special guest appearance. If you want to have your questions read out on the Empire Podcast, that's what this is called, right? The Empire Podcast?
I believe so, yeah.
Send in your questions. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag EmpirePodcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, on with the rest of the show. It's time for our first interview. Next Goal Wins is a wonderful and uplifting documentary that takes us behind the scenes of the world's worst football team. No. Not David Moyes' Man United.
Good, football humour.
Good, solid joke. But the American Samoa national team, as they try to recover from a 31-0 thrashing to Australia. 31-0.
So that's a lot, is it?
It's a lot. I could do with that score this weekend.
Oh, I should have converted the tries.
They should have done. Can you imagine? And anyway, not only did they try and score a goal after that, just score a goal, but they also try and win a game. It's wonderful, it's uplifting, it's moving, and it was directed by two Brits, Mike Brett and Steve Jameson, and they popped in earlier this week to talk to myself and Phil Dissembling. The first voice you're going to hear, apart from mine, is Mike Brett's, followed by Steve Jameson. And obviously, if you don't like football, give it a go anyway, because the movie will appeal to people who don't like football, and hopefully so will this interview. Enjoy! We're delighted to be joined in the pod booth by Mike Brett and Steve Jameson, directors of Next Goal Wins. Hey guys, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Fantastic film. It gets football right, which so many films don't in the big screen. What's the secret? Why is football so difficult to get right?
That's a really good question, actually. I mean, I guess I think actually a lot of it is to do with the way that we're kind of conditioned to kind of see film on football on film. You know, I think, you know, we're used to kind of multiple camera angles and kind of the high octane aspect of the game, and I think clearly in this film, high octane is not a phrase I would use to describe the American Samoan football team when we first went to see them, certainly. And I think for us, having come from a more of a commercial background, it was very much about trying to actually strip back all those layers that have been kind of almost added into the game in the UK and in other kind of very developed football nations, and actually just go back to the kind of jumpers for goalposts kind of ideology that we all had when we kind of grew up and were playing in the park.
I feel this film should be required viewing for anyone on £300,000 a week who maybe has lost touch with what the game really means and the emotions the game can stir in you. It's phenomenal. But in a way, you knew about the struggles of the Samoan team when you went down there. But in a way, was this film also a bit of a happy accident for you?
It was massively a happy accident. Like you said, we knew a little bit about the history of the team, but we had no idea about the journey that they would go on. And really, it was a bit of a voyage for Mike and I to rediscover our love for the game. And as you say, you know, you say it should be required viewing for anybody who's on £300,000 a week or... You
name
know.
Me no names.
Steve, are you...
that was just a random figure.
On that figure? Yeah,
that was just a random figure I plugged out of my head.
Can we lower the threshold to 50 quid a week?
Yeah. Oh, that includes me now. All right.
But yeah, a massive happy accident. We went there to rediscover our passion for the game, and I think we did that, and that they went on the journey in the meantime was pure fortune for you to when you're making a documentary, I suppose you hope that you've got a decent a couple of decent characters to follow, and we went down there because the team story was so good on paper, but when you go there and you find Nicky Salapu and you find Jai Sailua, and then if that isn't enough for you, uprocks Thomas Rongan, who yesterday was described as Steve McQueen, Lee Marvin. He's been described as the drill sergeant from Kubrick's films. What else has been described?
They reckon
as?
That Willem Dafoe's been suggested Dafoe. As a potential remake character.
You know, when somebody like that walks into the middle of your documentary, you know somebody's looking up there, smiling down on you. I mean,
speaking of Kubrick, he's not just the drill sergeant from Full Metal Jacket. He's a monolith from 2001. He just suddenly rocks up and makes everything happen.
I think the description of Steve McQueen in a tracksuit was the best we've had so far, and fully justified. The man,
not the Oscar-winning director, but
he was also described as Basil Fawlty yesterday as well. Which I just think is the sublime to the ridiculous.
Yeah, he was going to end up in Hollywood or Torquay apparently. So
where is he now? Because I've got a five-a-side team that needs some urgent attention.
We can arrange that for you. It's going to cost you. I mean, you know, we can get Thomas over here and he'll drill any five-a-side team in shape. Although I should say that we entered a team into a five-a-side competition when we were in New York launching the film for Tribeca, and we thought that having Nicky Salapu in goal, an international goalkeeper, and Jai Sailua in the middle of our back four and Thomas coaching would help us, and we lost every game very, very convincingly, so I can't promise that he will help.
In terms of Thomas, he played for Ajax, he'd sort of come through the ranks at Ajax, and he hadn't quite made it to the first team, but he's had an illustrious career in the MLS in America.
Certainly.
He coached DC United and he had a lot of experience there. He entered your film kind of in the middle of things, didn't he? It must have been for you, like, winning the trust of, first of all, the players, that you weren't just going to come and take the piss.
Yeah.
And then winning him over as well very quickly. I wondered how you got him on board with what you were doing.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in terms of winning the trust of the players themselves, I think the Samoan people are the most hospitable, the most warm-hearted people you will ever meet. And it was, I think once we'd actually made the commitment to travel 10,000 miles to be with them, you know, they actually realised that we were serious about making a film. And they also realised that we were serious about making a film for the right reasons. You know, we weren't there to take the piss. We weren't there to mock them. We were very much there to celebrate their attitude to the game. So that actually was, as you say, a trust-building process that took quite a while. But once we had kind of got embedded in the team and were wandering around in our Samoan Lovers and ILOA shirts, as we often did.
And you're still wearing now, which you point out.
Absolutely, yeah. You can't see under this woolly jumper, but yeah. But I think then it was a massive shock then that we heard that Thomas was coming along, and we were kind of braced for the worst, really, which was we were genuinely concerned that a guy who coached at his level, as you say, he was actually just finished up with the US under-20 team in their World Cup qualification campaign. So this guy, he knew the highest level of football. We were just terrified that he would just come in and say, "What on earth are you doing in the changing room for these, you know, these team talks? What, you know, why are you coming and eating dinner with us every night?" Because we had kind of full open access to the squad. But there were two things. I think one was the fact that the administration themselves were incredible. Tarita Tamua, the CEO who you see in the movie, actually said, "These guys were here first, Thomas. You know, we've kind of given them our words that they're making a film and they're kind of here. That's the deal," which was amazing to have their support. And I think Thomas actually very quickly as well, he's a very savvy guy. He understands what motivates people. And he could see not only that we were very close and we were friends with the team, but also that actually the cameras were potentially quite a useful tool to actually motivate them. You know, that we obviously had belief in them, we believed something was going to happen, and in a way he certainly never alluded to it explicitly, you know, he certainly never played to the camera, but I think he was aware that there was a sense of history building, a sense of a moment building.
You know, how do you go about assembling something like this, something so short from such...
It's a really good question, actually. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the actual entire shooting period was about 6 months, in which we had a bit of a two-month break kind of between two trips. The editing period was near enough 2 years, and that was because it was such a long time to hone. Actually, I heard a really good phrase. I think it might be from Walter Murch, the very famous editor, mm-hmm. where he actually sort of said that editing is a terrible word to use for that process, because you don't start with 1,000 hours of footage and whittle it down. You actually start with a blank timeline and you build from scratch what it is that you want to say. And I think that's a very good description of how we almost started from scratch and built each scene. We actually tried to structure it like a fiction feature film. You know, we didn't want to just be a fly on the wall kind of observational documentary. We really wanted to build those dramatic scenes in such a way that they pay off in the most satisfying way, both in terms of the character arcs and of course the team story. We knew we had all these amazing building blocks, but as you say, you need to, sometimes it's like a year and a half into the process, you suddenly discover a scene that you realise just has to go into the movie. Mm. And equally, in contrast, there's sometimes an amazing scene that you actually realise a year into the process has to be culled for the overall benefit of the movie. And that was some of the hardest moments, were actually cutting out those incredibly inspirational scenes in the movie, which we just knew weren't actually contributing to the overall structure as they should be.
Are there any other kind of touchstones, documentaries, sporting documentaries? I was wondering if you guys grew up with the Graham Taylor, the famous Graham Taylor. Do I not like that? Exactly. It just shows kind of how a documentary can get into the water in a way, because that's everyone, the only thing anyone really remembers about Graham Taylor is him standing on the touchline shouting, "Do I not like that?" did you have any other, are there any other documentaries that you felt kind of had done a good job? Because one of the things that's fantastic about your film is it really captures football, like Chris was saying earlier, in a way that feature films, where you can get the camera onto the pitch and you can do all sorts of funny things with the camera angles.
Like the Lingard at the moment, just throw his makeup.
Exactly.
I think Mike and I have got quite a lot of experience of filming football, and we have worked in the commercial arena as well, but we have one general rule each, which is that the camera should never make it on the pitch. It's the strangest choice that you would ever make, to take the camera on the pitch. If you want to, you know, make it feel real and authentic. In terms of references, I mean, we're massive soccer fans and we're massive film fans. So, you know, we're massive sport fans in general. So we have seen a lot of sports-related films. I guess from speaking personally, when we knew that we were making this, or once we started editing, we tried not to watch too many of those films, because it becomes, you know, that kind of classic underdog story is not an original one, and it would be very easy to try and ape what people have done before, and we knew that we had something really, really original, so we try not to borrow too much from them.
You didn't go slow-mo. Escape to Victory style.
We were just waiting for Stallone to rock up.
Exactly.
To be fair.
We did call Stallone. There's loads of movies in the past that I think have done a really good job of this. Nothing in the football world. Obviously, the Graham Taylor one was amazing because it was access all areas, and actually, rather than glorifying something, you see a man sort of reach the edge of madness. And I think Larry goes through a similar process in the first half of our film, where he desperately tries everything he can to motivate the team, and he was coaching the girls' team at the same time, which you don't see in the film. And that was a
breakdown over the course of 5 half-time team talks.
It was terrible to watch. It was so painful to watch, and you desperately wanted to try and help him, and there's nothing you can do. So, but in terms of references, I can't think of anything that we really wanted to borrow from.
I'm going to throw out Senna, because I was going to say, because although it's a very different kind of film, it's not about motor racing. You know, it's a human story, and I think that was always what we set out to do. Is that, you know, it's funny because it's brilliant that this film was actually appealed right across the spectrum. I don't think we'll ever again make a film that appeals as strongly to loaded as it does to Gay Times, and I think that is, you know, something we're really proud of, that it is a universal story, and bizarrely some of the audiences that you would think would least respond to it have responded incredibly well, and sorry,
like FIFA, for instance.
This is, and it's extraordinary actually, and it's it's a very difficult one because we're delighted, obviously, that the FIFA love this film and feel that it embodies the values of the game. I think that, you know, we strongly believe that's the case as well. And I think that actually the fact that, you know, we screened at Wembley the other night for the FA as well, this can only be good for the game and for tolerance and diversity in the game in terms of, obviously, Jaya's character, Fafafine, Way of the Woman. She's the first transgender player ever to play an international match. And I think that for us, this is a very small little movie, and the fact that it's being picked up and actually could potentially have an effect on the way that our national game is perceived is a really exciting thing.
You touched on your commercial background, and I know you guys have worked with Wayne Rooney.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Unrelated to any comments earlier about salary, etc. I just wondered, I mean,
it was just a figure.
In your dealings with professional footballers, is there a sense that, I mean, this is the kind of film that they get beaten over the head with a bit, isn't it? It's like, it's a fairy tale, but you people should, you know, be more grateful and more gracious in the way you act. Do you sense that they're kind of aware of that perception a little bit? And what sort of, I mean, you mentioned showing it to the FA, what kind of responses have surprised you from people involved in the game over here?
It's funny, you're right, we have worked with a lot of top pros, and we've worked with people like Wayne Rooney, and sometimes those have been difficult experiences. I wouldn't say because of him, I would just say because of the industry that is built around him. Actually, he's a player where he receives an awful lot of criticism about, you know, the level of the wages that he's on, but we've met the guy and we've kicked a ball around with him, and he's somebody who I personally feel that if you took those wages away, if you took the industry of football away, he'd still be down the park on a Saturday kicking a ball. He absolutely loves the game, and yes, there are pros that you get to work with where that isn't always the case, and you know, there have been pros in the past who I suppose have behaved badly and taken those wages in the industry for granted, and yes, this film is for those, should be shown to those people, but I wouldn't say that he was one of them, and a lot of the pros are desperately in love with the game, and so, you know, for us, it's we've been fortunate to work with those guys, and they have a certain love for the game, and I wouldn't want this to be beaten over the head with.
No.
Do you know what, it was interesting because Graham Lassow actually presented the film at Wembley the other night, and he was incredible because you know, he actually came down and watched the entire film. You know, he wasn't there just for the fanfare, and he said afterwards, you know, thank you to Jaya and Thomas in particular for reminding us of why we love this game. And I think Steve is right that we all went into it for the right reasons. We all love the game, from yay high to a grasshopper. But actually, I think that kind of love can kind of slowly dissipate, and you don't realise where it's gone until people like this remind you of it. And I think in that sense, I think actually all these people in institutions, all these players who've seen the film, the Socceroos have seen the film, incidentally, and loved it. Tim Cahill came down to Tim. It was actually amusing. Tim Cahill, the top scoring Socceroo of all time, I believe he'd bagged 31 to get that record, which is somewhat ironic because he came down to meet Nicky Salapu at the New York Premier, who had picked the ball out of his net 31 times against Australia back in 2001, and it was amazing to see these two guys embrace, who just have this pure love of the game in common, regardless of one of them is a millionaire and one of them is a guy putting up mobile phone masts for AT&T in Seattle, and I love that.
I actually screened the film for the Socceroos in a hotel last year when they were about to play Brazil and get a hiding similar to the one that they delivered to the American Samoan team. And it was amazing to see somebody like Mark Schwarzer, who's the Chelsea goalkeeper, so he's playing right at the top of the game, you know, in the last minutes of the film, sort of jumping to his feet and punching the air and exclaiming "Jaya!" You know, she makes a goal line clearance. So you think, you know, we all connecting on the same level in these things, and that was an amazing thing to see.
Fantastic. Well, guys, as I said before, whether you're a footballer who's fallen in love with the game, or someone whose football team have just blown the title by drawing 3-3 with Crystal Palace, this film will restore your joy and your love of the game. So it's fantastic having you again, Mike, Steve. Pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys. Cheers. Bye bye.
Time now for some movie news. Do we have anything happening in Hollywood this week?
I've got a couple of smallish stories.
Okay, dokes, we got.
I'd like to share. First of all, we all know that there's a Point Break remake coming.
We do know. Yeah, my petition hasn't helped.
I know. You were petitioning for it to happen, or
no, to not happen.
Okay, good. Just checking. Well, Jared Butler was lined up to play Bodhi, who is, of course, the part brought iconically to life by Patrick Swayze in the original. He was, but has now left because it appears that the schedule is going to clash with The London Has Fallen sequel, to Olympus Has Fallen.
Talk about a rock and a hard place.
Right. So he's just going to have to not. So the question now becomes, who will they get in instead? We put up an entirely speculative poll on the website. 52% of people say there shouldn't be one because there is only one Bodie and he's Patrick Swayze.
Lewis Collins is a pretty good one as well, I have to say.
Lewis Collins.
In The Professionals, Bodie and Doyle.
Okay.
Okay.
Anyway.
19%
say Matthew McConaughey because too few people saw Surfer Dude. Yeah, Nick's nodding to that one. All right. 17% Keanu on the basis that stars often swap roles for the remake. 9% Cameron Diaz. She surfs a lot. I think the world's ready for a gender swap.
Okay.
And 3%, and I think this was Chris, Sean Pertwee. Fans of Blue Juice.
I've got a good one.
Nothing to do with it.
I saw a YouTube video of an otter on a surfboard.
Okay.
That would be...
You know what?
That would improve this film.
I'm sold. An otter on a surfboard.
Yep. If that was the poster, I swear I would go see that at least twice.
So they need Benedict Cumberbatch then.
Oh.
Yes.
So anyway, it's coming. It's director Erickson Core. The other star is Luke Bracey as the Johnny Utah role.
Amazing. Is it amazing? I don't know. But can we imagine being Jerry Butler and honestly having to choose between London Has Fallen and Point Break? Do you choose what's certain to be the greatest movie ever made?
Yeah.
Or do you go for Point Break? I don't know. It's a tricky one.
Chris, let's play a game of fuck off. You go first.
Always, my friend. Always. What do you got?
I want you to work out what story I'm talking about from the phrases I'm about to say.
I like games. This is
good. Okay, you ready?
Ali's good at this.
May the power be with you.
Mm.
Let's rock it. Have a nice flight. See you next fall. This one's going to give it away. It's morphin' time.
Oh.
These are all catchphrases from the insanely popular and bizarrely still on TV Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, which is now being turned into a cinematic experience that will rival both Citizen Kane and all the X-Men's combined. Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the movie, is coming.
Didn't we get that last summer with Pacific Rim?
Oh,
hey.
Oh,
hey.
Snap.
Other classic phrases are, of course, Go Green Ranger Go and Power Rangers.
Okay.
We may not have our powers, but we are still Power Rangers. So
surely you're just Rangers at that point.
Well, yeah. Rangers, after they got demoted to the third division, they lost a bit of their power.
Wow, really. So much football humour.
I know.
I don't know if we're the core audience for this movie.
Although we're all dressed in different colours today.
That's true. I don't know. Who is watching this?
I think a lot of children all over the world.
Sure.
Famously, or at least amongst us, Bryan Cranston voiced quite a few voices in the English dub way back when. So do go to YouTube.
We'll go on YouTube
and type in
Snizzard
Cranston, yes,
and you will see him saying very menacing things about his Zapper Apple.
We won't tell you how to spell Snizzard because that would ruin the fun.
Now, as I remember this, back in the day, the Pink Ranger was the only girl, and the Yellow Ranger was, I think, Asian American. And the Black Ranger, I'm not kidding, was African American. And I'm wondering...
Why would that be?
I'm wondering if maybe, you know, the colour coding may have moved on since, but please tell me it's moved on since.
There are no details other than the fact that they're making the movie and Haim Saban, who own the property, are doing it with Lionsgate. No one's been cast. I mean, I hope that they just get four people in suits and then they just get famous people to voice them, because that would make me so happy, especially if it was slightly delayed.
Would it? Because, let's be honest, none of us are going to see this film.
I'm going to see the film.
You're going to see this film?
Yeah.
Really?
I would be honoured to review this film.
If Bryan Cranston came back...
So good.
As Splinter.
And he
You're making
back...
so many people unhappy by saying that.
I know.
Yeah, I just want to see a Zapper Apple.
I think we all do.
I think we almost saw it in the first episode of Breaking Bad when he...
anyway.
Tastefully framed. Yes, Helen, you got another one, haven't you?
I've a quick one, yes. Emma Thompson, recent Empire Award winner,
mm-hmm.
Has been cast in a role in A Walk in the Woods. Now, this is extremely exciting for me because the book is one of the funniest things I've ever read. It's by Bill Bryson, who writes kind of travel books, occasionally science books and things like that as well. But basically, he is one of the funniest men on earth. And this book actually made me cry with laughter. And if they can translate even a fraction of that onto the screen, it will be very funny. Robert Redford is making it, or is in producing it. He's actually giving Ken Kwapis the chance to direct. But he's been trying to make it ever since he was planning to do it as a reunion with Paul Newman. So it's been around for quite a few years since before Paul Newman's sad death. He's now planning on teaming up with Nick Nolte as the twosome who try and walk the Appalachian Trail at the heart of the story. They're obviously kind of fictionalizing the book, which was a non-fiction account of Bryson's attempts to do the same. I would guess Emma Thompson might be somebody's wife, I guess. I don't know. Also to cast are Nick Offerman, always good news, Kristen Schaal as well, and of course Emma Thompson. So I am officially even more hyped than I already was to see this.
Yes, I'm glad this kind of film is getting mentioned on the podcast because we should go watch this. It sounds great. All the things are coming together well. Nick Offerman should be somewhere in a wood crafting, saying wise things.
Yeah.
Sam Elliott should crop up for no real reason.
Sam Elliott with that moustache in the woods? Oh. Anyway, if you haven't read the book, also go read the book. I genuinely cannot recommend it enough.
If you are an aficionado of terrible puns, you may be familiar with the Steven Spielberg produced The Flintstones movie from 1994. Now, that wasn't very good. The sequel was even worse, but it is getting a Yabba Dabba reboot with a Flintstones movie. It is going to be an animated movie, and the folks involved are Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, which I think bodes well, although I could imagine Will Ferrell doing it live action.
I think John C. Reilly's a better Fred Flintstone.
I think
throwing it out there,
having him as the voice would be great. There's a Wreck-It Ralphy quality to Fred. Mm. Yeah, who will play the dinosaur that provides the sink destruction garbage disposal service?
Godzilla.
Yes, great shout.
Questions about the animation style. I don't want to see 3D animated Fred and Wilma. Mm,
you're right. I thought in my head I just presumed it'd be 2D.
Yeah, if it's 2D, how do you sort of fill the screen? It's an interesting one.
I think this is probably because of Peabody and Sherman, perhaps.
Now it's time for a second interview. He doesn't need much of an intro, does Michael Fassbender. He's emerged over the last few years to become one of the most charismatic and magnetic leading men around, but he's also a fantastic actor, as evidenced in the likes of Hunger, Shame, 12 Years a Slave, X-Men First Class, The Counselor, and you know what? Even Prometheus. His movie star face is tucked away for the most part in Frank, but when Helen and I went along to speak to him recently, we were relieved to see he'd taken off the mask and was in good form talking about all manner of things, including the likeable song. What's the likeable song, Helen?
Yes, we should explain that. Basically, at one point in the film, his character Frank tries to go populist and comes up with a song which has lyrics about Coca-Cola and McDonald's and everything that people like. So just bear that in mind when he starts explaining exactly what that involved. Here you go.
Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined our portable pod booth by Michael Fassbender, star of Frank. Hello, sir.
Hello.
How are you?
Very good.
Excellent, excellent. Now, first question is not about the mask. It's not about the music. I was taken by your shriek. At one point in Frank, you shriek. Now, did you know that you had that shriek inside you, and where did that come from?
That's my inner raccoon. I just wanted to sort of, you know, have something very kind of, I don't know, primal or, you know, something that's like, I guess something, it reminded me where we grew up, there was stoats and rabbits. And when a stoat would catch the rabbit, they usually sort of bite him around the head or the neck area. And there would just be a really high pitched sort of shriek.
Jeepers.
That they would make. And I just thought something very sort of feral or, like a real, you know, a cornered animal type sort of thing would be the right sound there.
That's amazing, because it surprised me. It was like, you know.
Surprised me too.
Yeah, did you know you had it inside you? Seriously? I mean, you know, I imagine the mask does help in that way, because it shields you.
The one thing that the mask was difficult with, actually, just reminded me, was sound, because it's so echoey in there. So hearing the you know, what the sound was, not for the shriek, but just for sort of, you know, accent delivery at times was kind of strange because it was so echoey in there. But yeah, that sort of shriek thing, once it happened, I was like, yeah, that's the sound that I wanted, you know.
Did you have any kind of models for the voice, for Frank's voice? Because it sounded, I don't know, it sounded weirdly Johnny Depp to me at times in one of his slightly weirder roles.
Well, oh, right. Well, I'm happy because I thought you meant the sort of singing. I haven't heard Johnny Depp sing, but yeah, a lot of people said sort of Jim Morrison. I was just sort of flipping. Yep. No, I did look at Iggy Pop. And so it was kind of a Michigan sort of accent, even though his house is in Kansas.
Who's counting?
Yeah, exactly. That's a minor detail. It doesn't mean anything.
Just a few hundred miles.
Exactly. It's just a couple of states. So that was an influence. And then, you know, Daniel Johnston, some footage that I sort of had that I was watching of him, and especially some of it when he was sort of in distress, that they were kind of the main ones.
And in terms of the script, I spoke to Lenny Abrahamson whenever he was filming the movie. He was when the first picture view with the mask came out. And he was talking about how you got hold of the script. He said they didn't send it to you. It just kind of worked its way into your hands somehow. So how did it come about for you?
That would have been my agent then, Connor. Yeah. Because he gave it to me. So he was like, take a look at this. Mm. You know, and that was it. So
were you looking for something, because you've been doing a lot of big movies recently. Yeah. Were you looking for something specifically smaller to do, to a sort of amuse-bouche, if you will, in between big projects?
Not really. I mean, it's really what sort of lands on the desk. And I don't actively really seek things out. It's just what's a good story or not. And then I just, you know, when I started reading that, I was like, whoa, this is really weird and unusual and original and funny. And I found it, you know, moving also. So it was a pretty simple choice, really. And then I was a big fan of Lenny's work. So it was a very easy decision. And that's just kind of the way it goes. It's whatever comes up at the time, what lands on the desk and whether it's good, and then who the director is.
What about the sort of mechanics of it? Like, did you have a stunt head and a, you know, everyday head? And things like that. Like, I'm thinking
there was different heads. Yeah. I think just, you know, different heads would sort of for for different jobs. It's like some sort of toolbox, isn't it? Adjustable heads. It was we had a couple of different ones, and then there's different elements of distress that happened to the helmet. So you know, switch them up. There's the helmet. I mean, there's the head then with the makeup on it.
I imagine there were you know, difficulties with peripheral vision. You said you talked about hearing, for example, but could you see anything from that thing? Or
not a great deal. Yeah. No, I guess it would be kind of like pushing your hands together and just looking through a little gap in your fingers.
Hmm.
And it's sort of out each sort of periphery. Couldn't see anything directly in front of me.
Oh my God.
I suppose freaked me out a little bit at the beginning, but after a while I just found it kind of fun. And yeah, like whatever, you know, putting on the head made me feel quite mischievous. And so, you know, let others worry about me banging into stuff rather than me. And you know, there is also, you know, there's a kind of liberation that comes with wearing a mask.
Yeah.
So it was fun.
So compare and contrast your experiences wearing that mask with on Days of Future Past, Magneto's helmet, because you only got to don it for a little bit in First Class. Is similar hearing problems or peripheral vision problems, or is that okay?
It's important with the Magneto helmet that I've got good vision.
Yeah.
Because enemies are about.
I could strike at any second.
Absolutely. I've got to be ready for him at any moment. And hearing wasn't, I don't think, a problem with the new helmet that I had. Maybe in the old helmet, but the new one is sort of, it's an interlocking piece, so it wasn't that bad. But I can always use it as an excuse if I don't like something that somebody's saying to me. I'm like, I can't hear anything. can't hear anything. Helmet.
You didn't find yourself on set of Frank as well, you know, telling people what facial expression you had at the time, as he does in the film, you know.
Yeah.
Happy face. Yeah.
Yeah. I just didn't have any change in my face, though. That was the thing. I was kind of just bored. No. I had much more fun not telling people, I suppose. There's a great picture that Carla took. I'm sitting, and Donald's sort of sitting across the table, and I'm just sort of giving Carla the finger as she sort of takes a picture. And it's a cool black and white photo, actually. I've got it at home. It's pretty rock and roll, actually.
Sounds amazing. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, you're not tempted then to actually go on tour with the band?
Yes. That would have been great. Unfortunately, it's trying to get everybody together at the one time. But yeah, we had a lot of fun work, you know, playing together as a band. And we were lucky in the way that we got to rehearse 3 or 4 weeks before we started filming. And so that was cool. We got to kind of, you know, gel together. And it was that helped a lot.
Were you ad-libbing the lyrics, or was it all off the page?
Not really. Maybe here and there in little bits, but Lenny had written such great accompaniments to Stephen's music. Stephen Rennicks did such a great job with the music, and so, you know, I didn't want, you know, what they had written was so good. unless something came and, you know, because we did try to keep things fluid and organic as well. So sometimes things would come and you sort of throw it in there. But that was in general throughout the piece, you know.
So Castonel was saying he had he's actually got some sort of songwriting credits now from the film for the stuff at the beginning of the movie where he's just kind of...
yes,
you know,
I saw that.
Yeah.
I saw that in the credits last night. I was like, yeah. Shit. Damn.
So you stayed and watched
the... what about me?
So you sit through the credits now. Is that what you do? Just in case.
Sit through the credits?
You sit through the credits of movies. Is that something you normally do?
No, because they were doing the Q&A last night.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just thought maybe you were watching it in case Spider-Man turned up at the end or something.
Okay. You just seemed like really excited there because that's something you do.
No, it's something that happens.
You're like
more
another
more.
One.
Yeah, another
You're
one. Like... Finally, you can join my club.
There's only a few of us left in the movie theater at the end.
There's a newsletter that comes out 4 times a year. So, yeah, look out for that. It'll be fun.
I was going to ask about the likable song, but I think you've kind of already answered it. That was a piece of, I thought, songwriting genius.
Yes.
With, you know, everything people like.
Yeah. Brilliant. Unfortunately, none of my doing. I just delivered it in a very scary way.
It could be like the hit novelty single of the year if you released it. I think that would be huge.
Yeah. I think, you know, we should release an album.
I think you should release an album.
I think it's going to happen.
We asked Donal to pronounce the name of the band. Can you also pronounce the name of the band?
Søren Frups.
Yeah, I feel like we've got two different versions.
I like
that's
it.
That's not surprising.
I like that version. That's good. Yeah, that's not too bad.
Thanks.
But you shot the bulk of the movie in Ireland.
We did, yeah. Wicklow and Albuquerque in New Mexico.
I was going to say Albuquerque's not in Ireland.
There's that little village outside of Abidorny. It's called...
Albuquerque.
Albuquerque.
Helen and I find, when we go back home, our accents become almost exponentially thicker.
Okay.
In fact, they're getting thicker now just talking to you.
Yeah.
What about yourself? When you go home...
Mine turns the opposite. No. I suppose that happens everybody, doesn't it? When you go back. For sure. Yeah, I think that's common.
Do you find any problems in terms of keeping up a different accent when you're doing that?
Keeping up appearances. Yes, every day. No, I don't really sort of stay in accent. I kind of go in and out. So
you also have a film, I think it's coming up, or announced anyway, The Trespass Against Us with Gleason Senior.
That's
Are you
right.
working your way through
I'm
the family?
I'm working through the family. That sounds weird.
It does.
sounds like a Terrence Stamp movie. What is that Italian movie where he works his way through the family?
Italian movie. There's the Limey? Is that the one you think
no,
of?
No. Much well, earlier than way, that.
Much
is it a Bertolucci film? Or no?
Oh, yeah.
No, it's not. Anyway, doesn't matter.
You guys talk. I'll Google.
Well, check that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do it.
Anyway, going through the family, the Gleason family. I'm really looking forward to working with Brendan. It was a dream working with Donal, and I've been a big fan of Brendan's for many years now. So that's really exciting.
And we were looking through your upcoming projects, and you have, I think, when we counted, about 11 million of them. So some quite busy times coming up. So what is actually next on your agenda at the moment?
Trespass. I've got to go home now and do some homework. Yeah, no, that'll be coming up, I think, beginning of June.
Okay, so you basically launch X-Men and then onto that.
Yeah.
And that is going to be, I imagine, one of the... You know, judging by the reaction at Comic-Con last year, judging by everything we've seen of it so far, one of the biggest movies ever.
It's going to be the biggest movie ever in the universe.
Amazing.
To date.
Are you going to
Can you believe it?
It's huge. It's made, what, $6 billion already? And
I
it hasn't
so.
Opened yet?
Yeah.
Are you going to sit through the credits on Days of Future Past?
Absolutely. I've got a little dance number at the end of those credits, which you'll want to see. Complete in Magneto outfit.
The post-credit sting. Well, that was almost the sting on Prometheus, wasn't it? You dancing as David.
Yes, I wanted that. On board, he has like a little disco room with the floor that lights up, you know? Those special disco floors.
Well, Prometheus
and we don't
too.
See enough of.
We don't see enough of those in hard sci-fi.
Yeah, exactly.
We just don't.
Sci-fi and disco, they're meant to come together. And they did for one brief, beautiful moment in Buck Rogers.
We never got to see David.
Yes.
But we might be going to see him again because obviously Fox have announced Prometheus 2.
Yes.
And they've said there'll be multiple Davids.
Oh, they have they?
Now, are you aware
of this?
You
know more than me.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you aware of this? Have I told you that there's going to be multiple Fassbenders knocking around or is it...
I heard rumours adrift. Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not sure where those rumours came from, whether it was from... Fox or...
Or from us.
Yes, exactly.
He made it up.
Yeah.
Is Assassin's Creed then still on the table? That's the other one that I know our readers are very excited about.
That is definitely on the table. Very excited about that. Yes, very excited.
I've lost the... I can't find the Terrence Stamp movie.
Oh, no.
I've let you down.
Man, how's that possible?
I've got no 3G coverage here.
No way.
I can't. I'm sorry.
Oh. Well, next time.
If we find it, we'll let you know.
Okay.
We'll let you know. That's a bad note in which to end, Michael, because I've let you down.
You have let me down.
I've let you down. But Terrence Stamp was probably Superman 2.
3G let us both down.
Yeah, I think so. I'm looking at you, EE. Michael Fassbender, it's been
a
pleasure.
A lot.
Thank you so much. Okay, so let's talk movie reviews now. And let's start with Mr. Frank. Very frank review of Frank. What do we think of this one? This is from Lenny Abrahamson, who last directed What Richard Did, the movie that launched Jack Rayner to stardom and the Michael Bay's radar for Transformers 4. Mm. What do we make of this one?
This is an interesting and a weird movie. If you're going along because you think Michael Fassbender is extraordinarily handsome and, you know, fair, you're going to be disappointed because he really does keep on the mask. He commits to that mask and you're not going to see a lot of his movie star good looks. However, that kind of is the point, really. So Donald Gleason plays our point of view character, if you like. He's a young man called John who we meet trying to come up with his own songs and, let's be honest, failing disastrously to come up with anything hummable. He then he gets called upon to join this rather experimental rock group who, as you heard, has an unpronounceable name and tries to, I guess, become part of the team. He's really inspired by Fassbender's Frank. He's really, you know, fired up by him. He wants to be just like him. He wants to take Frank to the next level and help this group achieve all that they can achieve at whatever cost comes along. And Gleason is right. His character is simultaneously the sort of the protagonist, but also kind of the villain in some ways because he just doesn't get it. He's extraordinarily naive. And just disastrous to be around in many ways. So, you know, the group is going to... the group, therefore, is going to go through quite a lot of turbulence, let's say, on its road to, well, what looks like stardom.
And is it strikes me, because I've edited both the interviews now, as a very dry film. It sounds funny, but is it a little too cool for school?
It is very cool. It is... it is both funny and often tragic and often really uncomfortable funny. This is not sort of, you know, hysterical, gross out lols. This is really kind of situational humour. A lot of the humour, for example, comes from Maggie Gyllenhaal, you know, continually threatening to punch Donald Gleason's character. And frankly, he really, really needs punched. So you're kind of with her on that. So, yeah, it is very good, but it is not going to be for everybody. And it's not exactly an easy film to sum up in a lot of ways.
It's quite dry and it's quite austere in the way it's shot and it's quite matter of fact, so it's not very glossy and brightly coloured and but I thought I loved this movie. I really did. I thought it was fantastic.
It sounds like a cult classic, not bestseller, to
paraphrase
the
I would streets. Absolutely say that's the case.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, there are some laugh out loud moments. Frank in the shower is hilarious.
The likeable song
is brilliant. Yeah,
absolutely destroyed me. And I think the performances are great. You know, Fassbender is wonderful under the mask. Great body language. Maggie Gyllenhaal's beautifully unhinged. But I think the film belongs to Donald Gleason.
It really does.
Yeah, I think he's great. And I it's weird. Maybe I identify with him a little bit more than perhaps you might have done. But I didn't see him as much as a villain of the piece. It's just a decent guy trying to do the right thing. But you know, I can absolutely see how you might.
He's awful.
I didn't get that. I honestly didn't get that. I thought he was just trying to help this band do well.
Yes.
In the process, destroying the band. But that's neither here nor there. It's very, very funny. And the music is good. The music is great. The score is fantastic. And the songs within the film are brilliant as well. And Fassbender's, yeah, got a decent voice. Even if it is muffled by a mask. We give it 4 stars. You know, that's it's a fantastic film, so do go and check it out if you can. Let's move on now to Sabotage. This is going to be very, very quick because I think I'm the only person in the room who has seen it. It's the latest salvo in Arnold Schwarzenegger's big screen comeback. This time he plays the shady leader of a shadier DEA team of hard asses who are picked off one by one by an unseen menace after they steal $10 million of Mexican mob money, the other members of the team are played by character actors like Terrence Howard and Sam Worthington and Morel Enos and Joe Manganiello and Max Martini, people like that. So it's really, really tough guys. It was co-written and directed by David Ayer, whose End of Watch I absolutely loved. It was one of my top 10 films of the year when it came out. I was desperately hoping this would continue the streak and be Arnold's first properly good film since his comeback. Sadly, I was disappointed. We gave it 2 stars. I think this is borderline 1 myself. I think it's almost unwatchable.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very, very poor. It's trying to be Predator in the sense of it has this group of larger-than-life personalities being picked off one by one by an unseen menace, but the plot itself makes no sense when you play it back.
$10 million doesn't seem like a very large amount.
It's not a large amount of money to kill for, and whenever the killer is revealed, their motivation is sketchy at best. The performances aren't great. Essentially, you get there's no clear delineation of personalities in Arnie's troop. It's one person with six different haircuts. That's essentially what's happening.
I have to say, this is one thing that's put me off the film. Really distressing facial hair. Yeah. I mean, really, really handsome team members, and then just awful, awful things happening in their foliage. Yeah,
Sam Worthington does not look like Sam Worthington for me at all. But I like the idea of Arnie as an anti-hero, like really as a bit of a bastard.
Yeah.
It
doesn't really work.
I haven't seen this film yet. I kind of feel like I have because I have seen the track listing for the soundtrack, which basically is a list of the characters' deaths in order for some reason. But I was on set in Atlanta, and I'm really kind of disappointed to hear what you said about it after you saw it, because I came back from that thinking this was going to be fantastic. They were all talking a great game, and I thought that it would be another End of Watch, but with Arnie. So it's sad that it's not.
It really spiralled on the blood hole in the US, didn't it?
It did. It did, sadly. And, you know, I'll say sadly, it's not a great film. Yeah, it's such a shame for me because I loved End of Watch, and I think David Ayer is a really interesting talent. I'm very, very excited to see what he does with Brad Pitt and a huge tank in Fury, which will come out later on this year. And I just thought his gritty aesthetic might have worked in this world, and Arnie might have worked, and it might have been the first proper great Arnold ensemble film since Predator, which is, you know, 27 years old now, that film. Wow. That's kind of weird and aged me a lot. But it just doesn't deliver. It doesn't deliver on any level. The mystery isn't intriguing. The performances are overwrought. The action isn't good when it happens. The plot is nonsensical. I think a lot of the blame can be laid at the script, which, so I'm going to say, co-written by Ayer. He overhauled the script by Skip Woods, the hack extraordinaire who is behind the likes of X-Men Origins Wolverine. It's not good. When I say borderline 1, I'm trying to think of redeeming features. Olivia Williams is okay as a police officer who investigates it, but the murders, I mean, the idea is that you're setting up these guys as the best of the best, and the idea is you're trying to set up this entity that's, well, whatever it is, or a killer that's picking them off one by one, and the deaths are meant to be gruesome, but basically they're all just drunken idiots. None of them are likable, not even Arnold. It's a massive shame because you know, I just think he hasn't really delivered since he came back. Last Stand I enjoyed for the last half hour was over the top. Escape Plan was leaden and inert, and this is just plain bad.
He was the best thing in it, though.
He was the best thing in it. He was great, and actually I think it's one of his best performances in years and years and years. But this is just not good, guys. 2 stars for that, but by no means is that even close to a recommendation. Very quickly, we also have The Wind Rises, of course, which is the final film from Studio Ghibli's head giblet Hayao Miyazaki. I'm usually good at Japanese. Hayao Miyazaki. What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, this is lovely, as you'd expect from a Miyazaki film. It's beautifully put together. It's kind of a very loose, highly fictionalized, let's be honest, biography of the aerial engineer, I guess, aeronautics engineer, I should say, Jiro Hirokoshi, who was the guy who basically developed the Japanese Zero fighter, which was a hugely, hugely successful plane during World War II for the Japanese. It was a beautiful piece of engineering. It's the equivalent of their Spitfire, basically. It was massively important during the Second World War. But what this portrays is a guy who was hugely idealistic, who just dreamed of flight, who dreamed of flying, who loved the air and wanted to create a sort of a perfect machine that would fly in it. And unfortunately, then, you know, guns get attached to it, which is, you know, outside of his kind of purview. That whole thing makes it a little bit difficult for Western audiences from one point of view, in that, you know, obviously the Zeros were a machine of war for a terrible regime. But on the other hand, if you can sort of divorce yourself from that kind of politics and history of it, this kind of fictionalized account of this man who just dreams of flying is something that you see in Miyazaki films over and over again. Yeah. There's sequences in Howl's Moving Castle that could almost fit right into this, to this movie, because it's just that dream of flight and that dream of being kind of unrestrained by human limitations.
It's very much a film about the imagination, and it's very biographical as well as the flying. It alternates between reality and these incredible dream sequences where you just see amazing stuff going on up in the air, and it's a really moving film. It's definitely one of his more serious films.
And it's a love story as well, we should say, between Jiro and his wife, and the sort of their relationship over time, and the illness that she suffers and how he kind of suffers alongside her, I guess.
Yeah, and there's definitely an element of him feeling guilty about the things that he's between creating these incredible machines, and then the guilt that he feels as they go on to be used in war. And there's some kind of nightmarish sequences as well as dream sequences, but it's a really, really interesting, complex film. I liked it very much. Yeah. And some of the best skies you will ever see. I was blown away by the skies.
Absolutely. We don't really want him to retire, is what we're saying.
How old is he now?
I mean, like, he's about the 80 mark.
Okay, so he's probably...
He's got many years left in him, okay. It's fine.
We give this 4 stars, yeah?
Yes.
4 stars for The Wind Rises. And there's a massively lengthy review of it on the Empire website.
Do not double bill this one with Labyrinth.
Okay.
That wouldn't be a good idea.
All right, fair enough. 4 stars for The Wind Rises. And very, very quickly, I will mention Next Goal Wins. We had Mike Brett and Steve Jameson in on the podcast earlier on. It's a fantastic documentary. Possibly one of the best of this year. Obviously, we're only still in May, but it's very, very good. And even if you don't like football, it's a wonderful, joyous, uplifting tale of losers trying to overcome their loserness. And I think it will make people fall back in love with the beautiful game if they have fallen out of love with it recently.
It's a sort
for whatever
of,
reason.
It's a sort of true underdog story, isn't it?
It is. It's very much a true underdog story. And we give it 4 stars. I give it 4 stars, but by extension.
Do you agree with that review, Chris?
I don't know. Yes. Yes, I do. I do. And that is it for this week's Emperor Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Josh Hartnett, star of the new Sky TV show Penny Dreadful, in which lots of horror icons team up together and try and do things. And we'll also have Gareth Edwards, the director of Godzilla, who'll be stomping our pod booth flat unless we ask him nicely not to. Until then, it's goodbye from Nick.
May I quote Viggo the Carpathian once more?
You might as well.
Death is but a door, time is but a window. I'll be back.
Viggo, or is that Arnold? What? Is that...
This was Viggo's last words before he died and then came back again.
Oh, wow.
Like Arnie.
Moving words. It's goodbye from Helen. Do you want to quote Viggo?
I wasn't planning to.
Okay. Could you quote Viggo? If...
No, probably not.
Viggo, oh, do the bit about the Castle
Viggo
of Skulls.
Yeah.
I'll get you, Ghostbusters.
There may come a day when the courage of men fails, but this is not that day, something along those lines.
And it's goodbye from Ali.
I'm going to leave you with my favourite Mighty Morphin Power Rangers quote. And it is genuinely, I actually like this one. This is a phrase they use. More phenomenal.
Oof. Let's all leave it there, shall we?
More phenomenal. Wow. Take that home with you and see if you can crowbar it into the conversation with your mum when you call her up and it goes on a bit too long and she tells you about the new crockery she bought. Just say, that sounds more phenomenal.
Wow.
See what she says.
That's amazing. That is huge. You know, I think we should probably sign off with quotes more often. I quite like that. I think we've accidentally stumbled upon something here. And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to immerse myself in the world of Miyazaki, a nice double bill of my neighbour Porco Rosso and Grave of the Ghiblis with the dog bus. Thanks, guys. See you next week.
Bye.